Hey folks, I want to dive deeper into something that I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers, Figs scrubs, made for awesome humans. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my Figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves her so much that it's all she wears to work. Ever since COVID, she's all Figs all the time. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a med student starting out. Investing in a couple pairs of Figs is totally worth it. We're partnering with Figs to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. Figs goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try Figs today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart, check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab tested, real results. Go to mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
Hey there, ACRackers. I want to tell you about a CME conference that I will be speaking at in the new year from February 28th to March 7th, 2026. It is an amazing conference. It is the Holiday Seminars Conference in Maui at the Hyatt Regency Maui Resort and Spa. I have been there before. I've spoken at this before, and it is incredible. The family, the Smith family that puts this on, they really do an incredible job. It's going to be some amazing speakers. It's a beautiful hotel and an opportunity to really enjoy Hawaii and Maui, and especially at a time when Maui is trying to recover from the wildfires. They're really going all out to try to make the tourist experience an amazing one. So I think this is a great year to come, and the conference is going to be incredible. You're going to hear from amazing speakers who are going to go over really, really high-yield topics. I highly, highly recommend signing up for this. You can go to holidayseminars.com and click on the Maui link, and you can register there. You can use CME money. It is going to be amazing. So I hope I will get a chance to see you there. It'll be a ton of fun. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am really excited to be back doing another Master Clinician episode, and a fantastic one at that. I am really excited to have with me Dr. Michaela Farber, who is the inaugural Mass General Brigham Chief of the Division of Obstetric Anesthesiology. She started that role just recently on May 1st of 2025, and she leads both the OB anesthesia divisions at the Brigham and Mass General. She's an associate professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School in Boston. And prior to that, she served for 3 years as OB division chief at Brigham and Women's. She has had quite a career. In the first 12 years of her career, she was OB anesthesia fellowship program director at Brigham and Women's. It's the largest program in the country with 5 fellows per year. And she is very proud of having mentored 56 fellows. And we're going to hear some more about her fellows. But I want to read some of the things that were sent in to nominate her as a master clinician for this series. So here are some of the things that were sent in. Dr. Farber's clinical expertise is exceptional. Her commitment to improving maternal safety is evident in her research on postpartum hemorrhage, focusing on preparedness, risk assessment, and the pharmacokinetics of tranexamic acid therapy. Dr. Farber has a longstanding interest in educational techniques that serve to enhance patient safety. Dr. Farber was invited to deliver the Gerard W. Ostheimer Lecture at the 2022 SOAP Annual Meeting, an honor that underscores her respected voice in the field. Dr. Farber's commitment to excellence in reducing maternal morbidity and mortality through sound evidence-based peripartum management has earned her influence in national professional organizations. Dr. Farber has had a profound impact through mentorship. Over 12 years as fellowship program director at BWH, she has trained and guided 56 fellows, many of whom now hold leadership roles themselves. Her influence on the next generation of obstetric anesthesiologists is widely recognized and deeply appreciated. Dr. Farber is not only a remarkable clinician, but also a dedicated educator, researcher, and mentor whose impact on trainees is profound and far-reaching. In the high-pressure environment of labor and delivery, Dr. Farber sets the standard for excellence with her sharp clinical judgment and unwavering commitment to patient safety. She earns the care team's respect through both her expertise and the empathy she brings to each decision. Whether managing complex cases like postpartum hemorrhage or high-risk cesarean deliveries, she leads with poise and grace, offering invaluable lessons in clinical leadership. When she speaks, the team listens, confident her decisions serve the best interests of patients and staff alike. What truly sets Dr. Farber apart, however, is her devotion to education. Despite the demanding nature of her role, she consistently makes time to teach, whether breaking down difficult physiological concepts, walking through complex anesthetic decision-making, or encouraging thoughtful questions, especially when things don't go as planned. Dr. Farber fosters an environment of learning and growth. Her dedication to our development as future anesthesiologists is evident in how she continually advocates for our educational experience while balancing the priority of delivering excellent patient care. Despite her numerous accolades, including the BWH Senior Mentorship Award and the Education Program Leadership Award, Dr. Farber remains humble, approachable, and deeply supportive of her team. She inspires many to pursue careers in obstetric anesthesiology and exemplifies what it means to be a clinician educator. So that's really something. And those are from multiple, both faculty and residents who sent those various comments in. Says a lot about her, and I'm thrilled to have her on the show. Michaela, welcome to ACRAC.
Jed, listen, it's an honor to be here, and I'm just blown away by your introduction. It's a wonderful feeling to have had this impact on so many people over the years.
It must be, and a real profound impact it has been. So I'm excited to hear some of what you have learned over the years and what you teach and what makes you really stand out, as you obviously do, in the minds of your colleagues and learners. So one of the things I mentioned up front is that you were a fellowship director for a long time. I know from our interactions that that was a really special time for you. You really cherished that time. And as we can see in some of the comments that were sent in, 56 fellows, that's a huge number of obstetric anesthesiology fellows, especially when many programs might have one or two total. And so talk a little bit about that. How did you become a fellowship program director and what did that mean to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I finished up my own training and residency and fellowship at Brigham and Women's in Boston. And after I graduated, I gravitated toward helping future fellows to find their research projects, because what I recognized as a fellow myself was that it's a short period of time, just 1 year. It's a real challenge to embark on meaningful research in that time. So with that interest, I was kind of nominated to be the director of fellowship research at the Brigham, and within the year stepped up into the role as director of the fellowship program. So huge honor for me, a very exciting step in my career way back then. But it was that kernel of research planning that really excited me, and I found a passion in that. And it continues to excite me to this day. So working with fellows, identifying what their curiosities are and what their strengths are, every single year that can look different from fellow to fellow and from group to group. But OB anesthesia is an incredible field where you can really observe clinical challenges, ask a question, and then we have the capacity where I work to design a study that starts to answer the question, and then to really feel like you're truly making a clinical impact, and specifically making maternal care better. So, you know, we've even managed to do this within the short course of 1 year fellowship. Sometimes it takes longer, but a lot of times we can manage to do really incredible things in a single year.
Yeah. So it is, I think that's something that especially people in, for example, internal medicine or pediatrics, right? They have these three now sometimes becoming 4 year fellowships in this huge amount of time. So to do a lot, especially in research in 1 year, is really impressive. And so it sounds like that was something you really prioritized. And how did you, I mean, say a little more about, you know, was it through kind of preparing people early? Was it selecting people who had some skills and knowledge already? How did you kind of manage to get fellows geared away so quickly and have, you know, them feel good about what they could produce in just a year?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, I think it really relates to the importance of identifying what a fellow is specifically interested in. They will kind of perpetuate their own productivity. If you can take a few minutes or take a few days or weeks up front during their fellowship or even prior to their fellowship and figure out what makes them excited to explore. And sometimes we can do that through talking to fellow candidates before they start. I, as a program director, I spent a whole lot of time exploring what their strengths are just based on what they'd achieved prior to fellowship. And sometimes people come with a blank slate, and that's equally exciting because then you can provide them with all sorts of, you know, prior research projects that have been achievable within a fellowship, and they can kind of think about, well, yeah, I'd like to take this this previous study in a future direction because I find this really interesting. So across the spectrum of experience that people are coming to fellowship with, you can almost always find something that resonates with them. In fact, I was on call with a fellow recently who just started. And at the beginning of the shift, he said, you know, I'm just really not interested in research. My fellowship is meant to really, you know, refine my clinical acumen and my clinical expertise. And by the end of the shift, he was super excited about doing a retrospective study with me based on something we had seen overnight. So it's just really fun to have that impact on people.
That's fabulous. Yeah, I think that's so common that people, I see it, of course, more people coming into residency, but I'm sure it's true of fellowship too, who come in and that's their thought. They've never, the research to them has been this thing maybe that people feel like you have to do if you, you know, maybe if you're going into a really competitive field, which didn't used to be anesthesiology, but now is more and more is becoming that, where you kind of, you know, it's like a have to, and it feels burdensome. But I do think there are people out there like you, clearly, who can help people see that it doesn't have to be that way. It can actually be a really neat way to explore something you're passionate about, as you said.
Yeah, absolutely. You can demystify it and you can kind of take it apart and approach the challenges of research in chunks. And I think that having mentors around you who have had experience is, you know, something I can't emphasize enough for the importance. The reason I'm an obstetric anesthesiologist is my mentorship that I got from people like Lawrence Sen, Bill Kamen, Bhavani Kodali, Jeannie Carabuena. You know, the mentorship is pivotal, I think, to kind of influencing our future specialists in any field, but OB anesthesia is no exception.
Absolutely. So you say, I know you like to say that there's never been a more exciting time to be an obstetric anesthesiologist, but at the same time, I think some residents feel like, well, I don't need to do a fellowship in obstetric anesthesia. I can go practice OB without, unlike, let's say, critical care, where you can't really be an attending in an ICU without a critical care fellowship. You can, at least in private practice, you can absolutely do OB anesthesia without a fellowship. So talk a little about that. Do you need to do one and why?
It's a really important question, Jed. And I think hearkening back to when I was thinking about doing OB anesthesia fellowship, I was very interested in cardiac. I was interested in peds. I was interested in OB anesthesia. And multiple people back then said to me, why would you want to do OB anesthesia? You know how to do epidurals. You know how to take care of OB patients. And I think to your point in that when you graduate from residency, you can practice OB anesthesia without fellowship training. There's a misunderstanding that you don't need the training. And I think until maternal outcomes are improved in our country, we really should advocate for better training, better refinement. And I'm thrilled that we have 20% of our graduates going into private practice, because I think that's a really clearly defined pathway for enhancing maternal care outside of academics.
So 20% of your fellowship graduates go into private practice with their fellowship. And I bet that, and you may know this, I'm sure you keep in touch with a lot of them, if not all of them, but I bet you haven't found any of them who say, you know what, man, I wish, what a wasted year. I wish I hadn't done it. I bet not one has said that.
No, you're so correct. You know, I think the last time I checked, nearly half of our graduates have leadership positions, and it was both inside and outside of academics. So I think it, you know, doing the training in a fellowship, you really strengthens your administrative leadership skills, your ability to work with a multidisciplinary group of people, especially when complex patients roll through the door. So you're absolutely right. And the OB anesthesia community, by the way, is very close-knit. So I do get feedback all the time from these graduates. And you're correct. I've never heard of any regrets about fellowship here.
Yeah. And it seems to me, again, from the outside, that there's just increasing comorbidities. Patients who maybe wouldn't have even survived their congenital heart disease as a kid now are not only surviving, but they're having children themselves. You've got, you know, the scope of practice of an OB anesthesiologist is wider. You've got sicker patients. It just seems to me like there's more and more need for that specialized training. And this is me just looking in from the outside.
No, you're absolutely right. We've got some really wonderful publications in the last 10 years emphasizing the importance of, for example, the cardiac OB team that that emphasizes having an obstetric anesthesiologist on board with cardiologists and maternal fetal medicine specialists to manage patients who have congenital or acquired heart disease. The incidence of placenta accreta spectrum is really increasing over a short period of time, likely to do with higher rates of cesarean delivery, but other factors as well. So we have these really, really high risk hemorrhage deliveries that are happening on a more routine basis. So these two topics keep us very engaged in terms of educational strategies to enhance maternal safety and achieve better maternal outcomes through better OB anesthesia care. You know, I think also to your point, if you look at OB anesthesia training and patient management, some papers have shown differences in care. Just if patients are managed by OB anesthesia fellowship trained physicians. One paper back in 2019 showed that if patients were managed by OB anesthesiologists, they were 40% less likely to receive general anesthesia, for example, for cesarean delivery. So there are signals out there in the literature that are evolving to suggest that our fellowship training does make a difference and enhance the care that maternal patients receive.
Yeah, I believe that absolutely. And, you know, I thought of it recently when I was listening. I don't know if you've listened to the most recent season of The Retrievals, but, you know, what sort of seemed very clear, and let me be clear, I don't know anything about the actual details of it. I only know what they said on the podcast. But, you know, is that, as you would imagine with anything, if you do something a lot, you're going to be much more comfortable with it. And in that case, it seemed to be around, are you comfortable with when it is, in fact, time to say this block isn't working, let's go to GA? And if you don't do it very often and you just take occasional OB call, then maybe you're less comfortable, you know, with exactly when those subtleties play in. I'm sure the same thing comes from, you know, with a placenta accreta, right? If you don't do it very often, it's maybe it'll go well, maybe it won't. If you do it all the time, then it seems to me pretty obvious that then you're going to be better at handling that stuff. So that seems clear. I think we know it's clear if you have a surgeon who does brain surgery, heart surgery, abdominal surgery, orthopedic surgery, right? Of course, that doesn't exist. But if it did, there's no way they'd be as good as the individual specialists. And I think the same, why wouldn't it be true for anesthesiology? And so we do have that in many ways, right? We have people who do liver transplants and specialize in that. We have people who do cardiac and specialize in that. And we now have people who specialize in OB anesthesia. And it seems to me very clear that that should produce better outcomes. And it's interesting that at least some data is suggesting that.
No, yeah, you're right. And I'm really glad you brought up the Retrievals podcast because it's really sparked a lot of incredible interest and much needed attention to the patient experience. And the fact that a general anesthetic is not always, should not always be considered a negative outcome, right?
Right.
So I think actually some of the research we're conducting this year is centered around that very question. How do we define what constitutes general anesthetic as an unfavorable obstetric anesthesia outcome? It's included as a metric in our centers of excellence to have a low rate of general anesthesia, but you certainly, to your point, don't want to avoid the use of general anesthesia when it's absolutely indicated. So I'm really fascinated and excited by this, and specifically, I'm really excited in thinking about the patient experience. I think that post-COVID and in this time where we have just, you know, electronics abounding around us and everything we're doing in anesthesia from the medical record to all of our tools, it's really going to be important to step back and focus more on the patient again, as much as we can. And this specific topic of you know, the patient's experience during cesarean delivery is just ripe for that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's talk about some of the kind of lessons you've learned and things you've grown to practice yourself. And you like to structure this, I know, by kind of the fellows and that you've had and some of the projects they've worked on with you. So let's talk about that. What are some of the things that your 56 plus fellows have taught you?
Well, I could talk to you about this for hours, Jed. I mean, I think that, as I said before, one of my favorite things to do is to spark interest and passion in fellows, especially when they think they're not interested in doing research. And it usually and almost always starts with a clinical question that they have. One year, Dr. Hans Swigum, who's I'm proud to say is now the division chief of obstetric anesthesia at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and he has been a chair of the Minnesota Society of Anesthesiologists. When Hans was a fellow at the Brigham, he was curious about the catheters we use for epidurals because they're for OB anesthesia, we use the AeroFlex tip catheter. It's a soft catheter to avoid the risk of intravascular cannulation, but they're soft and flexible. So for that reason, sometimes they don't thread and it's super frustrating. And you think you're there and you can't get the catheter to thread and the woman's in active labor and it's a lot of pain. So Hans was curious, what is the incidence of this problem and what should we be doing about it to fix it in real time? He followed thousands of epidural placements during his fellowship and surveyed people to find that the incidence is about 5% that these catheters don't thread. And they're associated with a higher risk for having a wet tap. So when you get frustrated, when you're trying maneuvers, you have to keep that in mind and try to be cautious. So this was, you know, a really high yield clinical finding that he asked and answered within the course of a short year. He was an overachiever.
It sounds like it. Now, is there an answer to that? I mean, is there anything, do we need better catheters? Is there a better way to handle the catheters? What's the takeaway from that study?
Well, I think the takeaway back then was that this is something that is not a trivial incidence, nearly 5%. And he found that the best maneuver was to start over and recite the needle instead of trying to twist the needle or advance it slowly in terms of the lowest rate of wet tap and the highest rate of success. But the takeaway now that I could tell you is that with post-COVID materials shortages, we have to be really careful when our kits change and our equipment changes. One example is replacement needles have been very problematic recently for an increased rate of inability to thread a catheter. And they're too long to perform combined spinal epidural or dural puncture epidural techniques because the hub is longer. So we actually had to order longer spinal needles. So there's a whole host of things that are happening with material shortages that have to we have to stay on our toes to handle and think about the implications for these complications like dural puncture.
Interesting. So just out of curiosity, and this, again, I'm maybe speaking about things I don't know enough about, but let's say that you had not an emergent C-section, but, urgent, and the patient does not have an epidural, so you decide to do a spinal, or let's say you decide to do a CSE, and you have good loss of resistance, you get CSF through your spinal needle, you give your spinal dose, but you can't thread the catheter. Would you put the spinal needle back in and give more of a spinal and go with that? How would you, let's say you don't have time to recite and restick and try again. How would you deal with that if that were the issue?
It's an excellent question. And for that reason, when I'm doing a combined spinal epidural in the operating room for the purpose of a longer surgical duration, I'm always going to plan upfront to dose a long-acting spinal. So if it doesn't thread, then communication is king. And I tell the obstetrician, look, I don't have an epidural catheter to sustain my anesthetic. And that tells them in so few words that they need to scrub quickly.
Yeah.
So I think the combination of always doing a long-acting spinal for the risk that it might not thread is reasonable. I wouldn't want to wait and try to redo my epidural because then I just get a saddle block. And the worst of both worlds by letting the spinal settle. So you just kind of go with what you can. And if you can't thread the catheter, move forward and communicate and counsel the patient, because we're back to that patient experience of, not wanting to alarm the patient, but letting them know what you're thinking in terms of a backup plan, which might involve sedation and it might involve a general anesthetic.
Great. So I know you had a fellow who took a look at using music to handle or try to address patient anxiety. Tell me about that and what you learned from that.
Oh, this was one of my favorites, Jed, because I'm a music fan. I'm a piano player myself. My favorite composer is Chopin. But this particular fellow is just a maestro, Dan Drzmalski. He's now the division chief of OB anesthesia at Tufts University. And he's the director of QA and QI there. So he's always been a meticulous type and always been a music aficionado. And he wanted to know if playing pre-selected music or self-selected music before a C-section for a patient lowered their anxiety during C-section. So he followed 150 patients having C-sections. Some were enrolled to listen to this gorgeous Mozart music before surgery, which frankly, I think is what I would choose if I was nervous. The second group got to choose their own Pandora music, and the third group had no music. And what he found was that anxiety was lowest in the Mozart group compared to the controls. So a simple maneuver, wonderful environmental, enhancement, in my opinion, is a really easy way to kind of impact how much anxiety patients are feeling.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, folks, if you've ever been listening to a patient's heart and lungs in pre-op and wondering if there's some mild wheezing or a faint murmur, you are not alone. I used to struggle with this all the time until I got my echo. Honestly, listening through an echo is like night and day compared to a regular stethoscope. That's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and there's noise cancellation to cut out distractions. I can't emphasize enough how amazing it is when you can hear so clearly. The other day, I heard a murmur that my colleague with a regular stethoscope just couldn't hear. And you can unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI along with sound recording and sharing for earlier diagnosis. Echo is backed by 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms. Those who use it are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. I can't tell you how much better I can hear hearts and lungs in my everyday practice with my Echo. I trust Echo so much that I worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/ACRAC. Your purchase is HSA and FSA eligible and may qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently if you don't return it for a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/ACRAC for $50 off plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/ACCRAC. Hey, folks, between busy schedules and summer plans, if you're like me, you barely have a few free minutes and you want to be outside enjoying the weather, not stuck inside shopping and cooking. Factor solves that for you with their chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals that are ready in just 2 minutes, taking the hassle out of eating well. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and it really does. Even my 2 younger daughters, who are very picky eaters, are loving every meal we get from Factor. Some favorites are the chicken tikka masala and premium proteins like salmon and shrimp that come at no extra cost. And with 65 different meal options, you've got GLP-1 friendly meals packed with protein and healthy fats and savory global flavors like the new Asian-inspired meals influenced by China, Thailand, and more. Honestly, I'd still eat them for the convenience even if they weren't so delicious, but the amazing thing is that it's super fast and incredibly tasty. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Get started at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's code ACCRAC50OFF at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off plus free breakfast for an entire year. Hey folks, the holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, the best finds can sell out fast. I found this beautiful, handmade, customizable gardener's basket for my wife that she absolutely loved. It wasn't just that it was helpful for gardening. It also made her feel that she was helping an independently owned small business, and she said it was the perfect gift. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone. From moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners, you'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. So shop early, have fun, cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ACCRAC. That's uncommongoods.com/ACRAC for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Hey, ACRACers, we are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC. All right, and we're back and talking about the music study and anxiety.
Yeah, I love that both because obviously it's wonderful to hear that about music, but I think just in general, and I see this sometimes in some of our young trainees, is they think that it doesn't really matter what happens from the time you get to the operating room until the time you're asleep. It's kind of like, well, they're going to sleep anyway, you know, they're not going to remember, but it is amazing. I've had, because I always do a very I think of it as almost like a hypnosis or meditation that I kind of talk the patients through as very calmly as I'm getting ready to put them off to sleep and then as I'm giving them medications. And I've had patients who will contact me after to say, you know, that was so peaceful and calming and it stayed with me. They do remember it and it did make a difference. And there was a breast surgeon at UCSF where I trained. I wish I could remember her name, but she would ask the patients in their clinic visit before surgery what song they would like her to sing to them as they were going off to sleep. And then if she didn't know it, she would learn it, but she knew a lot of songs. So she would often know it. And then she would come in the operating room and while we were getting the patient off to sleep, she would sing the song to them. And it was, I mean, you could sometimes see the heart rate would come down. And this is before the meds went in, the heart rate would come down, the blood pressure would come down, right? I mean, I think it makes a big difference and it's fun that you guys actually demonstrated that.
That is above and beyond. And the only thing I can hope for is that she had a good voice.
She did. Beautiful, beautiful voice. Yeah, yeah. Unlike me, I do not sing because that would cause a lot of increased heart rate.
If there were windows, they would crack.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
But I will say, Jed, to your point, I think it's incredibly important what we do prior to our anesthetic instead of just showing up and meeting people with sterile gloves on and saying, okay, I'm going to do your spinal now. What I do in my own practice every single time I'm on the labor floor is I'll walk back to the operating room with the patient before C-section. And I'm not doing that because I need to hold their IV. I'm doing that because I want to establish rapport with them and figure out how they communicate and what their priorities seem to be and how nervous they are. And it's so much information you're taking in. It really informs the future steps to the anesthetic you're providing. And I try to teach that to trainees as well, because I think it's often overlooked.
Totally agree. Oh, I love that you showed that. All right. So talk to me about what you did with Dr. Sharon Rial, who, of course, was one of my residents before she was one of your fellows. She's fabulous. And what did you two do together?
Well, first of all, I love that we have this connection through Sharon because she's incredible, as you know.
Yes.
And she was always thinking about education, even from an early stage in her training. And really, she wanted to identify high-yield publications that our fellows should absolutely read before they graduate. And I think she did this on the cusp of becoming a fellowship program director herself. She is now our fellowship program director, and I have to plug that it's the largest fellowship program in the country, and Sharon just does such an exceptional job leading it. But what she did was really interesting. She surveyed the keynote speakers from our SOAP annual meeting called the Ostheimer Lecture, and did a sequential survey based a survey that was sequential to generate consensus among these experts in our field about what papers they thought were the most important. So they looked at what each other wrote and established consensus. And she came up with the top 22 papers, and it remains part of our fellows curriculum to this day.
That is awesome. Go Sharon. Yeah, every specialty should do that. It's not easy. I remember, I think maybe when I was an ICU fellow or maybe right after that, but I thought, I was like, oh, well, this should be easy. And I think I just emailed all of the intensivists here. And I said, send me the papers you think are the seminal papers that like every fellow or resident should know about critical care. And it was very, like, nobody sent it. You know, it was like, it was not easy. So I'm impressed that the Charon made it happen.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's hard to get traction on. And surveying the people who took I should mention that the lecture that we give at SOAP called the Alzheimer Lecture involves this intense year of assessment of the entire calendar year's publications in our specialty and a distillation of what's the most important based on the expert speaker's opinion, essentially, but with their background knowledge, of course. So I think asking those people who spent so much time thinking about papers was a really cool way to start. And it gave some traction for us to generate this list from. And I also think that we should redo the list because obviously there are going to be up and coming papers that we would want to include. So the list will continue to grow.
Yeah, that's fabulous. There's a group of wonderful educators who do a similar thing each year. They do a kind of best education papers of the year that gets published in the Journal of Education and Perioperative Medicine. And it's great. It's so useful. And I know at ASA, there's those kind of talks, right? The best papers of the year on this or that subject. And it's so useful. All right. So what about, I know you've done some work with obstetric hemorrhage prevention or management. Tell me a little bit about that, how you manage that, and what some of the projects around that have been.
Absolutely. Hemorrhage research has really become my passion over the years. And really, the mantra I have is that we can always do better. That's my mantra for care, any anesthetic I provide, but specific to hemorrhage, you know, we have to think of it as the leading source of preventable morbidity and mortality in obstetrics. So it's a really effective thing to focus on as an obstetric anesthesiologist if you want to try to make a difference. So one night I was sitting around our lounge between tasks with a fellow, and this consensus bundle from the National Partnership for Maternal Safety had just been published. This was back in 2015. And it's a bundle with 13 elements in it that expert consensus guideline suggested every labor unit should strive to achieve on their unit for the safest maternal care. This fellow and I decided on a whim on a call night that we would design a study around this and survey our group of nurses and obstetricians and anesthesiologists at the Brigham to see whether we had these bundle elements in place. And again, we did this Delphi survey study where you do sequential surveys across groups to generate consensus. And we found that nearly 50% of our bundle elements were deficient. And I just love this study because it really demonstrates that even a really high functioning unit like ours has plenty of room for improvement. And that study, by generating consensus across groups, it really embraced the OB anesthesia and obstetrics culture of teamwork and how important teamwork is. And just by getting everybody talking about it and identifying these deficiencies, we generated so much movement for change. And I'm proud to say we've adopted many, many things over the years to reflect improvement in those deficiencies. So it was just a really high yield project we did very easily.
Yeah, that's great. Now, this may be an impossible question to answer. I'm sure you could and probably do give hour long talks on this alone. But if you had to say, like, what are some of the real key elements in terms of hemorrhage management and prevention that you have adopted and you would recommend that the places do? I'm sure it's all 13 of those, but, you know, are there certain ones you find that are harder, that are, you know, important, but maybe not as often done? You know, what would you really highlight from that?
Let's start with life-saving ones. Having a blood bank, that can provide you with blood products within minutes has been life-saving on our unit for me for many, many, many cases of hemorrhage, because obstetric hemorrhage is similar to trauma hemorrhage at times. It's very unexpected at times. Even if it's expected, sometimes the severity ramps up and the coagulopathy is insidious in onset and unpredictable. So having a blood bank and having a system of communication with your blood bank that allows you to have units of blood cells released, and not necessarily massive transfusion protocol, because that actually takes longer to generate all of the products to send. But our blood bank can send us 2 units of packed red cells during an acute hemorrhage crisis. and it allows us to catch up a little bit. It allows the surgeons to catch up a little. That has saved us so many times. I can't emphasize that enough. And the other thing that was really high yield is having uterotonic agents. So uterine atony is the most common cause of postpartum hemorrhage. And we found that some of our second uterotonic agents were too far away at the time of hemorrhage. So simply putting the drugs in proximity to where the surgeries are being done was a really high yield and easy step to take on our unit to make care better.
And these are like Methergen and Hemabate?
Yeah, exactly right. So Methergen and Hemabate. Now we have fibrinogen concentrate also in that same area, right outside of our operating room, so that they're very easy and very accessible. And, you know, the newest evolution of hemorrhage management has been tranexamic acid. And I want to highlight some of the work another former fellow has done on our unit with TXA, just, you know, looking at the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of it when you give it, because TXA is something that before 2017 wasn't that common in terms of treatment for postpartum hemorrhage. A recent study, a study back in 2017 called the Woman Trial, demonstrated that there was a secondary outcome of lower death from specific to hemorrhage. Again, a secondary analysis, and in a study that was done in a very low resource environment across the board. So the question became, well, TXA may not be as helpful in our resourced environment, but are we doing any harm? And so we looked at the PKPD of the dose recommended now internationally, a gram, and repeating a gram 30 minutes later if hemorrhage was still ongoing. And we found that the serum levels peak in 3 minutes after dosing at a very safe level in terms of not being near thrombotic or seizure-related serum levels. So it was a really great study to do because it has clinical relevance to kind of reassure us that even though TXA is not as helpful in our environment where we have all the resources at our fingertips, it's not harmful either. And the dose we're giving is really effective.
I love that because it's, you know, we so often we get these big studies and they show this thing is effective and you know, we get on board and we start doing it. But then the follow-up questions are maybe just as important, right? So, okay, now we're doing this. Is it working? How do we know it's working? Maybe it worked in this one trial, but is it working for us? Are we causing harm? How do we know? Right. So this kind of having that curiosity is really important. And it sounds like what you with your fellow were able to show is it was safe.
Yeah. And that was Sebastian Seifert. And he is now the inaugural leader of, his title is Senior Division Director for OB Anesthesia at the Brigham. We'll have a Senior Division Director at the Brigham and one at Mass General, Dr. Emily Nayum. So super proud of the work he did, and he continues to just impress me every day with his leadership skills. But to your point, Jed, the harm done is such a great, I think when you have these examples in history within your career, right, of practice change, talking about the pitfalls of it is really powerful. And one of the things with TXA is accidental spinal injection of TXA. You can consider low resource areas, people drawing up drugs who are not actually administering them, the absence of spinal kits that have the local, the bupivacaine in them already. Spinal injection of TXA has been reported a lot in the literature, and it's 86% mortality.
Wow.
So you have somebody having a C-section, trying to get a spinal, they have accidental TXA injection, and the case reports are horrifying. So I like to teach that as a way to remind everybody of the importance of looking at labels for every drug we give and the fact that you can survey most anesthesiologists. We've all had a drug error at one point. And so it's very humbling to think about and to understand when the stakes are really high. And that's things like spinal dosing.
Yeah, absolutely. I did not know about that, but that is a great reminder of, and I tell, you know, our new residents, I say, I've been doing this a long time. I still read every label. If I'm programming a pump, I look up there. I don't just click the, yes, it's 8 and 250. I look up and I say, is that what it is? Let me read this label. What's actually in that bag? Same thing, you know, the blue vial, man, that blue vial is probably Zofran, but you know, maybe not. So it's so important to just build that habit.
Yeah. And to come to work every day at your best, you know, getting enough rest, enough balance, enough nutrition, knowing when you're too tired and you need to take a break. All of these things are so central to what we do.
Absolutely. By the way, I wanted to make sure we shouted out your fellow who did the work on the maternal safety obstetric hemorrhage bundle, because I don't think we mentioned her name, but that was Anne Maria De Tina.
Yes, and I'm sorry I didn't mention her name. Anne Maria is she went on from fellowship to serve as former chief or as chief of OB anesthesia at McMaster University in Ontario, and I still see her at the SOAP meetings most years, and she's just have had an incredible career thus far in anesthesia since this study.
That's awesome. Well, I know you could talk forever, probably at least 56 different times about your fellows and all the work that you've done. But this is such a great, I think, example of wonderful work done by fellows in just 1 year. And again, it really says a lot about them and you that so many of them have gone on to leadership positions in OB anesthesia. But let me ask you to kind of sum up some of the most important things that you have learned and that you teach and that you think we should keep in mind as we go forward.
Well, I really want to end, Jed, on talking about what really matters and why, again, I think it's the most exciting time to be an obstetric anesthesiologist. And the reason, the core reason I think that is that all of this research, all of this effort, all of this enthusiasm and training our future is to provide better care for mothers and their newborns. And I think now more than ever, women deserve this advocacy. They need it more than ever before because we have the worst maternal outcomes of any industrialized, wealthy country by far. If you look at the statistics, we have diminishing maternal health services nationwide. This is compounded by states continuing to propose new abortion restrictions. And last but not least, we have glaring race-based disparities. If you look at the CDC data on maternal mortality ratios, as recent as 2020, the MMR was 55 per 100,000 for Black women, and it was 19 per 100,000 for white women. I think these things are just egregious. And, you know, to be able to be in a position to try to tackle these problems is incredibly meaningful. I think obstetric anesthesiologists can be activated and inspired with these concepts to be part of the solution. And we're doing this in real time through the Society for OB Anesthesia and Perinatology. Back in 2022, I founded the SOAP State Representatives Program with then president of SOAP, Dr. Klaus Kajer. So I just want to tell you about it really quick. And what this is an effort through SOAP to identify a SOAP member in every single of our states across the country. And what that SOAP state member does as a representative is they look at all of the delivery hospitals in their state and reach out to them. So we're forming a network that's at the state level affiliated with SOAP. And part of that, so we can share all of the resources that SOAP creates. And I'm the vice chair for the education committee at SOAP. So we're constantly creating tools for OB anesthesiologists. So making sure that people can have access and realize what's out there through SOAP at the state level. We also asked the state reps to identify a mortality review committee member on their state's MMRC. So the group of people who review maternal deaths at the state level, you would be shocked to know that many, many states didn't have an anesthesiologist at the table to review maternal deaths.
Wow.
So hemorrhage deaths, cardiac arrest deaths. There's got to be someone with critical care expertise reviewing these deaths to be able to come up with solutions. So we've managed to sign up nearly 10, I think at this point over 10 actually, MMRC members who before states didn't have an anesthesiologist at the table on that committee. So I'm beyond excited about the SOAP State Reps program. And this is just the beginning. And I think we're going to create and identify ways of higher impact throughout the years just by having this established network and growing the network and what it can do.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And we'll put a link to that on the show notes. I know that you've had folks be involved in, and it does seem like OB anesthesia is such a rich opportunity also for global health work, right? I mean, that's something you've had fellows involved in too.
Yeah. And it's almost like we don't have enough hours in the day or days of the week or weeks of the month to get all of this work done. But I absolutely, another passion I have is that we increase our global footprint, both at my hospital, but just in general across the country with our colleagues. Some of the projects we're working on right now at the Brigham are involved in Kajabi, Kenya, Hanoi, and Hue, Vietnam. We have collaborators in Mexico City and also now in Bangkok, Thailand, and in China. So through these collaborations and through these trips that we establish with our fellows from year to year for outreach, what we're doing is we're focusing a bit on the educational infrastructure because that's what our collaborators have expressed the need for is more education in OB anesthesia. But we're also doing quality improvement projects, so identifying how we can help their systems improve. And I have to say that my experience with these places and these colleagues across the world has taught me as much as I think I've taught them. So it's just an incredible, true collaboration in both directions.
Fabulous. Well, Michaela, this has been great. Let's turn to the part of the show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something you'd recommend that the audience check out for fun?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mentioned this before. I'm a music lover. I am a musician myself, but I want to just emphasize that post-COVID, we need to get out there and we need to create experiences in the public arena. And Boston, I'll put a plug for, has incredible live music venues. And I would recommend that you do yourself a favor and listen to a couple bands that are up and coming and established. Lord Huron, which is a band outside of California, as well as The Smile, which is a spinoff band of Radiohead, a band I've appreciated since I was in high school. But both of these bands have played in Boston at small venues in the past couple years. And I think just, you know, listening to the beauty of this new music, exploring new music and getting out there and enjoying it in a public setting. It's post-COVID. It is really enriching for your soul. So don't deny yourself that. Get out and listen to some new music.
That's awesome. I love that. Thank you. I'm going to recommend a book that I am about to finish. It's been fabulous. It's called The Correspondent by an author named Virginia Evans. I've never read anything like it. The entire book is a series of letters to and from the main character. And all the story is told kind of through those letters. And it is both really well done and a very kind of heart-touching, heartfelt story. But also it has reminded me about, you know, how wonderful written communication can be and has inspired me actually to start reaching out to some folks who, you know, don't live near me, who I can't get together with regularly, but who I would like to be in better contact with than an occasional phone call, and to just write some letters or emails. In the book, it's letters. She feels very strongly. The main character feels very strongly that letters are better than emails, but I think either way. And so that's been a great book and I recommend people check it out.
Fantastic.
Michaela, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jed. Thanks for having me.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.